Patsy Wright's face was permanently bronzed, leathery, like that of a man who had spent much of his life out of doors in many different climates. As he made his way down Grafton Street, he seemed to blend into the picture so that nobody would really notice him or pick him out. He'd been there, close to her a couple of nights ago, and again in Belfast. Now, he was still only a few paces behind her, and relieved that Charles was not around. Charlie would have spotted him by now, as Patsy would have said. For your basic desk driver, Charlie's quite good on the street. Patsy was exceptionally sharp himself, and specialised in minding people who were being allowed to play in the deep end. But Bex would not have picked him out anyway, for she did not know Patsy Wright. She'd never seen him, never met him, but knew a little of his past alliances with her new husband. Certainly she knew that Patsy could be the best friend in the world, or conversely, the most dangerous enemy. Charlie had left no doubt about those qualities.
"Nobody behind you. Nobody on your tail."
"None I could see. But why would there be anyone?" She did not realize that she was pulling her mind back from the unpleasant possibility.
"You can't be too careful, so. Nowadays you can't."
The car hit some standing water in Baggot Street, sending a little plume of spray arcing from the front offside wheel. And Tess felt her stomach lurch, for Jimmy McLean had put a voice to the fear that had been within her since that stupid telephone call.
"Shall I tell him?" she wondered. "No, where should I?"
"And there was trouble, I hear. Some of the lads on the piss at the telephone."
It was as though he'd read her mind.
"You'd know all about that?"
"Of course. Connor Boland gave me a bell. Honest about it. Very loyal. Took the blame for it. He was in charge, and he screwed up. Badly. I've sacked the whole team and moved the telephone out. Relocating. Changed the number, everything. And why wouldn't I know about it?"
They were heading south through Ballsbridge, past the RTE studios, clocking up the miles toward the Wicklow Gap, which was always the favourite route for them. The rain was beginning to ease off, the sky lightening behind them.
"Is that safe? Firing those boys? Won't they talk?"
"They know nothing, except for the one lad who messed up when you called. Garner's getting new people. He'll take care of it."
Jimmy paused and gave her a quick glance.
"One way or another."
There was no doubting his more sinister meaning.
"So?"
She'd been up at Trinity with Jimmy McLean, who was a famous man even then, a star now with his own legal practice. But he was more silent than the grave, and knew how to organise clandestine services even back then, in his student days. It was Jimmy who always ended up with the contracts for Alchemist, though by the time the details reached him, the shadowy men who wanted the service done had been filtered through a muddling maze of checks and balances. Jimmy was always moving his base of operations, changing the unofficial telephone numbers, ducking and diving. Yet you would never think it to see him in his solicitor's office, the height of respectability. Now he was in his mid-40s, and Tessa had known him since the days when he was a year senior to her at Trinity. Even then there had been something about him that gave off a sense of trust and honourable credibility. He carried confidence like an aura, wonderfully turned out. Nobody ever saw him in need of a shave or haircut. In the office or in court, he wore immaculately tailored suits, heavy, expensive shirts with double cuffs, quiet silk ties, and heavy cufflinks that were always a talking point, ceramic copies of Victorian hot and cold water taps, or genuine old gold coins set in contrasting mounts, little watches that worked, or, his favourite, blue enamel circles with hands pointing left and right. These he invariably wore reversed. Today, however, as on all days, he met clandestinely with Tessa Murray. Jimmy McLean was not looking himself. He wore casual clothes, unpressed jeans, and a black, scuffed leather bomber jacket, over a well-worn grey T-shirt that bore the legend "Winnie the Pooh for Tao Siach, Prime Minister." He also wore aviator wraparound sunglasses. His dark hair was ruffled, his face unshaven, and he drove the battered old Rover, not his usual gleaming Beamer. For someone like McLean, this was all that was needed by way of disguise. While people would take in the glasses and maybe the T-shirt, few would have given his face a second glance. Fewer could have identified him as the suave lawyer who was so well known in Dublin society. His reputation was of more than squeaky cleanliness, and few had ever penetrated the darker side of his particular moon. Tessa was one of that tiny circle, and had been for many years. In her second year at Trinity, when she'd suddenly found herself in need of some dodgy assistance, Jimmy McLean had unexpectedly come out of the woodwork, and to her aid. Tess had grown up cheek by jowl with the Troubles in the North, yet she had carefully avoided publicly taking sides. As a student, she passionately believed in the Republican cause, but had the sense not to see the provos in any romantic light. Her political faith also held to the concept of peace, only through the force and violence of the provisional IRA. To her mind, the British presence in Northern Ireland was not only unjust, but also immoral, obscene, even. To some extent, this was a reaction to the fence-sitting, hypocritical, wishy-washy stance of her Roman Catholic parents. However, Tessa Murray was realistic and very down-to-earth. When she was finished at Trinity College Dublin, she would have to live out her professional life in the North, or possibly in the United Kingdom. From a purely financial viewpoint, London had an undeniable pull to it. So, with no illusions, she kept her head down and rarely made any committed comment, allying herself with the PIRA in any of its many manifestations. The crunch came in her second year at Trinity, in the summer when she made one of those steps along the good intention path that could well lead to hell. In short, she tried to make a little bridge back to her parents. She had done it before, and she would do it again. And it would always end in tears and guilt, for her ma and da really could not leave things well alone. It was a sunny Saturday, and she'd vowed to stay until Monday night. But she was already revising her plans because of a spat with her mother over some trifle that led to a melee. Tess needed to get out, so by mid-afternoon she was wandering along Royal Avenue, not really buying, but on the brink of being reckless with money. As she stared into the big plate-glass window of a lingerie shop at the white, black and pink display, vaguely toying with the possibility of dropping 15 quid on a tarty satin nightie, she sensed, more than saw, the man standing just behind her right shoulder. Medium height, which means short of 6 feet, jacket and grey flannels, his shirt open at the neck, and a lock of salt-and-pepper hair falling over his right eye. He sighed and spoke. It's a terrible problem women have in making decisions. The accent was not local, but much softer, definitely from the south. Not necessarily, she said with a smile, and glanced back, to be held for a second by his grin and the ice-blue eyes. Then she turned completely and asked if she knew him. Those were the days before talks or fragile ceasefires, and though she'd seen little of the violence, Tess had that caution anyone in Belfast at that time seemed to be born with. And if they were not born with it, they learned bloody fast. That is, if they had any intelligence at all. He said, well, they knew each other now. His name was Rory Deacon, and he wasn't being forward, but would she come and have some tea with him, because he was awfully lonely, and she really looked a nice, well-brought-up girl. You're not from here, from the north, are you? It came out in a slightly accusatory tone, which she'd not meant, and she stumbled over her tongue, wanting to justify it, then not bothering. No, I'm from the Free State, as folks here call the Republic, Dublin. But I have to spend the odd day up here. I travel, represent publishers, 4 of them from across the water. I'm a distributor, and they ask me to check on the shops here sometimes, about once a month. His eyes seemed to give a little sparkle, and the amused smile never left his lips. I'm going back to Dublin tonight.
I'll take you up on the tea.
She tentatively pushed her hand out and told him her name. His hand was dry with a firm grip. A man with square shoulders, who looked you straight in the eye and knew what he was doing. Confident, he marched her straight into a cafe and ordered tea and disgusting cakes. The waitress giggled and seemed to know him, at least by sight. If we were in Dublin, I'd take you to Beshoff's for the fish and chips.